Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, a place of hospitality and dialogue here in the heart of the Eternal City. The Lay Center for students at the Pontifical Universities moves to a new location close to the Colosseum. And a top Muslim scholar shares her thoughts about the future of interfaith dialogue. Nestled between the remains of a Roman aqueduct and a temple dedicated to the Emperor Claudius lies a little haven of hospitality and dialogue in the heart of the Eternal City. Rome's Lay Center, or Foyer Unitas as it's also known, was founded almost a quarter of a century ago to provide hospitality with an emphasis on ecumenical and interfaith dialogue. Today, the center hosts students from a dozen different countries from diverse Christian, Muslim and Jewish traditions. It also runs a packed program of lectures and courses on church history, spirituality and dialogue, offering a warm welcome to visitors and friends from all over the world.
I like to call it an oasis in the city because it's a beautiful, tranquil spot that is really very conducive for study, for reflection, for prayer. And we hope that people who come here enter into the peace of this space and that it renews them and refreshes them so that they can go out to serve others.
Co-founder and director of the Lay Center, Dr. Donna Orsuto, is a professor at Rome's Gregorian University and a former consultant with the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue. Following the center's recent relocation to the grounds of a Passionist monastery where popes traditionally went for spiritual retreats, I talked to Donna about the origins and the vision of this international interfaith community.
Well, really, the idea grew out of the experience of Foyer Unitas, because Foyer Unitas was an ecumenical center, actually started in 1950 to welcome non-Catholic visitors to Rome.
A revolutionary idea in the days before the council.
Exactly. And then during the Second Vatican Council, it evolved into an ecumenical center, a place to welcome especially the non-Catholic observers to the council. And it was a great place of dialogue, encounter, friendship, sustenance for people from different backgrounds who came there. So when I came to Rome already in 1979 and was helping out at Foyer Unitas, this ecumenical spirit was very important for me. So it goes without saying that when the Lay Center started, my colleague Ricky van Velzen and I, both of whom had been involved in Foyer Unitas, that an ecumenical dimension was essential, was important. So from the very first years, we welcomed people, Christians from other backgrounds, to the Lay Center. And then this developed gradually, and we not only welcomed other Christians, but people from other religious backgrounds, Muslims, Jews at times, and also at one time even Hindu students.
Now, a guest house is one thing, an ecumenical center is something quite different. How does this religious, this interfaith or ecumenical aspect form part of your daily life here?
Well, I think the important thing is what I would call a dialogue of life. There's a natural sharing of our lives with one another. So the Lay Center is not just a dormitory or a guest house, but it's really an intentional community where people on a daily basis are willing to share about their backgrounds, about their religious beliefs in a very natural way, which I would call a dialogue of life.
And religious affiliation, you're saying, is an important part and then of the people who come here.
It is. Obviously, the Lay Center has a strong Roman Catholic identity, so it's important, especially in the context of dialogue, that people really live their own religious faith. So we would have a commitment at the lay center to a life of prayer in the Roman Catholic tradition, the celebration of the Eucharist, also formation in Roman Catholic theology, that we would, those who are Roman Catholic, would really grow in their faith. At the same time, there's a desire to be open to dialogue, to learning about the other. For example, I remember once some of our students taking a group of us to the mosque for a visit so that we could understand how Muslims pray. Another example would be we had a lecture by a Jewish scholar, Rabbi Jack Bemperat, and we also invited a Jewish musical group of young people here in Rome to come and play some traditional Jewish music. And so giving people not only an intellectual experience of learning about the other, but also to enter on a cultural level into the music of another religious tradition.
A very full program, don't you, of activities, lectures, and other cultural events?
That's correct. There is a lot going on here. We have actually three levels of activity. The first is we have the student community. This year we have students from 12 different countries. And so there's a full formation program for these students, so that they would be in contact with leaders here in Rome who would help them to grow intellectually, spiritually, and so forth. Then we also have a local program where we offer courses and retreats and lectures for people who live here in Rome. And finally, we have an international program. We have programs for people who come from abroad for week-long intensive programs. For example, we will have this year the 6th annual Association for Catholic Colleges and Universities Rome Seminar. This is a seminar for university presidents and key administrators who are coming to Rome to reflect upon Catholic identity at Catholic universities, mainly in the United States and Canada. And so they would come to Rome for a dialogue on this topic.
I am kind of responsible for assisting and organizing those various programs. The other area that I'm involved in helping with has to do with the student community here. And then finally, I help with publicity, various things like newsletters and websites. And
a familiar voice on Vatican Radio, that of our colleague Rob White, who also works as assistant director of Rome's Lay Center after spending time there as a student some years ago.
Creating, providing materials, both print and web media, to promote the Lay Center and its mission.
Tell us something about the student community here then, what sort of numbers you are and where people mostly come from.
Well, this year we right now have 20 students living in the house from 12 different countries. We have 14 students living in the community this semester, the second semester of this academic year, who are Roman Catholics. And those students come from several various countries, including in North America, Canada, the United States. From South America, we have a student from Chile, another student from Mexico. From Europe, we have one from the Netherlands, two from Italy. Then we have two students from New Zealand who are Roman Catholic. But then in terms of Christians from other traditions, we have living in the community this semester three Orthodox Christians, one from Serbia, Serbian Orthodox, and two Greek Orthodox students who are both from Greece. They make a great contribution to the life of the house. In addition, we have three Muslim students this semester, one from Albania, one from Egypt, and one from Turkey. Most students come to live at the Lay Center at least for a year, and all the students who live with us are registered at pontifical universities, even the non-Catholic Christians and the non-Christian students, which is very interesting.
If you had to describe in a word, what do you think is the most important thing that the students who are here for a short period or a longer time, what do you think is really the most important thing they go away with after their experience at the Lay Center?
My impression is the experience of dialogue, of living in community. For many students, this experience is very new. And for many of them, it will be the only experience of this kind of living that they will have in their lifetime. Because it's not simply living in a residential dormitory. This is an intentional community where we not only share, shall we say, aspects of what would be dormitory life in terms of a single room and sharing bathrooms and common spaces that are available to all of the people who live here. But more than that, we have moments of formation, moments of prayer. People are expected to participate in terms of how taking on house responsibilities. Everybody, for example, everybody takes turns during the week doing dishes in the evening because we have one meal together, principal meals in the evening. So it becomes, it's not just a place people come to hang their hat, so to speak. I mean, it becomes theirs in a way. It gives people ownership. No, this is their community. It's their house. It's not just something they happen to sort of be passing through that belongs to somebody else.
You're talking about moments of prayer together. How does that work out very practically if you're having, for example, a Sunday Eucharist? How do other people from different denominations and different faiths take part in that?
We are a Roman Catholic community, you know, with a very strong emphasis on promoting ecumenical interreligious dialogue. As such, the prayer life of the house is Roman Catholic in nature. So we do have a weekly mass, which various priests and bishops from around Rome, principally, but also visiting, are invited to come and to preside at that weekly celebration of the Eucharist. And then we have other celebrations, principally based on the Liturgy of the Hours, according to the Roman Rite.
Would you also have prayers in other traditions or not?
We do not have prayers in other traditions that are sort of make a part of the regular rhythm of the community, no. People who live with us, who are or belong to other faiths, are certainly encouraged to pray in their own traditions, and space is given to them in order to do that. That's very important to us. For example, helping our Muslim students, for example, be in contact with or the mosque here in Rome and to find what they need, spiritually speaking, in order to live their faith.
We had a Muslim from Ghana in the first semester who was up doing the ablutions for prayer at about 2 or 3 in the morning. And one of our students who was an Anglican from Scandinavia didn't realize that this is what was going on, thought somebody was just in the shower at some hour of the morning that was a little too early, and that prompted a conversation to, you know, just present itself. What are the forms of prayer? Where are the ablutions? What times of day does this happen? And actually then being next to a monastery can reflect on the pattern of life between Christian monasticism and the daily prayer life of every Muslim.
A.J. Boyd is a fellow and student of ecumenism and interfaith relations at Rome's Angelicum University of St. Thomas Aquinas. He's been interested in Christian unity since childhood and finds life at the Lay Centre an important addition to his academic experience.
Obviously, being Catholic means being open to ecumenism, to interreligious dialogue, and the opportunity to have that dialogue of life, that dialogue of charity, which always has to precede the dialogue of doctrine or truth. I've been to ecumenical and interreligious meetings for years in my previous ministry setting, but somehow you learn more when you're sitting at a dinner table or up at midnight talking about life issues with a housemate who is Muslim from another continent than you do at a one-hour-a-month meeting with the other pastors in town.
Now, you said being a Catholic Christian means being open to other traditions and other faiths, but it's not necessarily true.
Well, perhaps part of that, I think, is just a matter of reception of all the work that has been done. For example, I was born in the year John Paul II was elected Pope, so I have a different experience than some of my colleagues in ministry and in academia. But the amount of work that was done by previous generations and in the wake of Vatican Council for Ecumenism, now we have so many dialogues, it's a matter of living them out, bringing them into the life of the church. There's so much that's been accomplished and is being accomplished. My generation's task is how do we unpack all these wonderful gifts? You just have to read the teachings of the council, of the popes. John Paul II was extremely clear that ecumenism is an essential part of being Catholic, not an extracurricular activity. And Benedict XVI has continued that theme as well. So it's not very difficult to see that kind of support from the highest level of the magisterium.
I think it takes at least one generation for the teachings of any council to come down to sort of the grassroots level.
A former lay center resident, Aureli Hagstrom, now teaches theology at Providence College in Rhode Island after deciding to specialize in the role of the laity in the life of the church.
For me, the lay center is a kind of greenhouse for a theology of the laity. It's a place where we think about what it means to be a layperson in the church, and I think it's a kind of almost a laboratory for understanding the mission of the laity in the church. For me, living at the lay center actually gave me the topic of my research, which I have been engaged in the last 20 years. I wrote my dissertation, in fact, on the vocation and mission of the laity in the church precisely because I was living at the lay center. What I think is that the church's teaching on the vocation and mission of the laity is one of the best-kept secrets of Vatican II. Although Vatican II had quite a bit to say about it, I find that even 40 years after the council, still lay people themselves are unaware of what the church has called us to in terms of bringing the kingdom of Christ.
There are those who are concerned, as you know today, that these teachings of Vatican II are somehow being lost or being rolled back, is the expression we hear. Is that a concern that you share or not?
I don't think that the teaching on the laity is something that's being rolled back or that's being forgotten. I think it's taken us some time, first reforming the liturgy and reforming how we think about mission, and now I think we're mission to the world, that is, the church's position in the world. And now when the church thinks so much about what its role is in the world, in the secular world, here's where the laity come in.
There are many, of course, at the moment who are saying if this role of the laity had been recognized earlier, perhaps we wouldn't be facing the crisis that the church is facing today. Do you agree with that?
I think the only silver lining of the crisis that I see as someone who is a theologian, particularly in this area of the laity, is that this, in a sense, forces laymen and women to understand that they have a responsibility within the inner life of the church and not just in the secular world.
On April 14th, 2010, staff and students at Rome's Lay Center officially inaugurated their new premises with the celebration of Vespers led by Bishop Brian Farrell of the Vatican's Council for Christian Unity in the small 13th century church of San Tommaso in Formis, or St. Thomas at the Aqueduct. In attendance were ambassadors, journalists, members of many religious congregations and institutes, past and present friends and associates to celebrate this haven of hospitality for people of all faiths and cultural traditions. But just how much does the work of the Lay Center reflect the direction and ideals of the Catholic Church and its hierarchy today? Director Donna Orsuto again.
What we're doing is a very modest project, a very modest activity of dialogue, a dialogue of life. And maybe, at times officially, it might seem that things are going in a different direction. But I believe that on a grassroots level, dialogue is alive and it's happening. And what I find very exciting is that especially among young people, these young adults, that they are building bridges for the future. I'll never forget once at our table having a Jewish student from Jerusalem sitting next to an Egyptian woman. They would have never met each other. Or Turkish students and Greek students, Greek Orthodox, Turkish Muslims sitting next to each other. And to me, that's a real sign of hope for the future.
This center seems to be very much led by women. Is there a particular, do you think, vocation, a female vocation perhaps, to this interfaith dialogue in your view?
I think that women do have a special role in dialogue. And I think part of it is the capacity to create a space, to create a home to create an atmosphere where dialogue can happen. And I think dialogue isn't only an intellectual activity. Intellectual activity is absolutely important. But there's also an affective dimension of dialogue which is important. And I think that women, as well as men, of course, can create that. It's very important to create that space for dialogue to happen.
My thanks there to Dr. Donna Orsuto, co-founder and director of Rome's Lay Centre, to assistant director Rob White, to A.J. Boyd, a fellow at Rome's Angelicum University, and to Aureli Hagstrom, associate professor of theology at Providence College, Rhode Island. And if you want more details about the work and the programmes run by the Lay Centre, you can find them at www.laycentre.org. Islamic Perspectives on Judaism and Christianity was the title of a lecture given here in Rome recently at the Pontifical Angelicum University by a top Muslim scholar. Originally from Pakistan but brought up in Scotland, Mona Siddiqui teaches Islamic studies and public understanding at Glasgow University and is a well-known voice for Muslims in the media. During her talk to staff and students organised by the John Paul II Centre for Interreligious Dialogue at the University, Professor Siddiqui discussed the Islamic understanding of scriptures and the divine nature of Jesus, stressing the ways followers of the three Islamic faiths have been profoundly connected over the centuries and forced to find a pluralistic understanding of their theology.
There's lots of theologians in history as well as contemporary theologians who have talked about pluralism in the same way that I'm trying to express today. But I think it's something that has to be said over and over again so the message gets wider and more people understand the implications of this.
Sharing her views with journalists ahead of the lecture, Mona Siddiqui said she's optimistic about the future of interfaith dialogue and believes one of the most important tasks is to communicate the complexities of theology to the ordinary man and woman on the streets of London, Lahore or Los Angeles.
One of the reasons I engage in public life is precisely because I think the public at large in Europe and in America is interested in theology made simple. So how you distill the kind of complexities of theological argument into something that the public can understand. And I think this is a message that needs to be said to the public over and over again.
You come from Pakistan. It's a very difficult country at the moment.
I was born in Pakistan. I was raised in the UK all my life. But I know about the situation of minority religions in Muslim countries. And I think there is a real issue there. And I think the perception for a lot of people is that Muslim communities demand tolerance when they live abroad, but they can't give tolerance. And I think a lot of us are trying to disassociate ourselves from that kind of vision of Islam. So the problem is, you know, some of these messages are very simple messages, but they have to be repeated. And one of these is, how does one give and receive in a spirit of generosity?
Optimistic or pessimistic about the future of the dialogue among religions?
You have to be optimistic because I think in our globalized world where cultures and religions and people are colliding with each other all the time, you have to understand that we are all connected.
Your ideas, you're saying, are not necessarily new, but you are proposing some quite controversial ideas, perhaps, let's say. What kind of reaction do you have from mainstream or traditional Islamic leaders when you talk?
I think there's a lot of people who think that why am I not being more apologetic about Islam, and why am I not saying that it's about time other communities tolerated Islamic ideals? My point is not about taking sides on this. I happen to be a Muslim who's grown up in Europe, so my life is all about the interconnectedness of people and different cultures. So for me, it's about how do Muslims see themselves in non-Islamic societies as both minority groups, and also what kind of vision do they have for their life as Muslims living in Western countries?
How difficult are these two things to put together, if you like? Some see it as a circle that can't be put into the square.
No, for a lot of people, I think that being Muslim in Europe is just a reality, just a fact. And they don't see a struggle. But there are people who are struggling, and they're not just Muslims. There are people of all faiths who are struggling with how to express their faith in society. And at the moment, I think the spotlight is in Islam, so we're focusing on Islam.
When you're talking to young people, for example, it's also true that faith is increasingly difficult to talk about in a very secular society like Britain and elsewhere in Europe. How much is that a problem, do you think, not just for Islam, but particularly in your sphere of work?
I think young people are not disassociated from faith. I think they're drawn to faith. But I think they find traditional methods of talking about faith or traditional institutions about faith slightly problematic. So a lot of young people are finding their own spaces about where to have their dialogues, both Muslim and Christian. And so this is why you're finding new organisations and new institutions being set up. And I think older generations have to recognise the traditional ways of talking about faith may seem completely disingenuous to the younger generation.
You're talking about dialogue, interfaith dialogue, as not a necessity, but more of an option or perhaps even a privilege. Doesn't this in some way undermine the efforts of those who are dedicated to this area of work?
For us in the West, where we are not afraid of violence, we're not living in conflict areas, it is a privilege. It's a necessity, it's an ethical necessity for me, but it's not a matter of life and death. But for people who live in conflict zones or people who live in communities that are so close but are at loggerheads with each other, then dialogue has a different dimension to it.
How much do you believe that dialogue can in any way serve the wider causes to try and prevent conflicts, to try and resolve or provide some solutions to situations like the Middle East, for example?
Dialogue on its own can never do what is needed. There always has to be political will and political backing. But leadership has its own voice and its own audience, and leadership in any capacity must struggle to make people understand that what they think, what they say and how they act matters to us all.
You've often heard, of course, said that Muslims don't have easily identifiable leaders necessarily. This is a common criticism, sure, if you like. What's your answer to that?
That's absolutely true. Muslims don't have easily identifiable leaders. It's not a faith that has a tradition of institutional leadership. But that doesn't mean to say that people who have something to say should not be allowed to say it.
What are the most important things, do you think, that we should be looking at in terms of lessons to be learnt from Islam? What do you think are the most important things that Islam can bring to this interfaith dialogue?
I think that Islamic history has been eclipsed by, or the good of Islamic history and the intellectual engagement between different religions has been eclipsed by the events of recent years. And in some ways, it's about the kind of generosity and the intellectual exchange that went on that has to resurface in Europe between all religions.
How do you really remain faithful, the dilemma between remaining faithful to your own religion and being open to other faiths?
I don't have a problem with remaining faithful to. I mean, I think the imperative in my religion is to be open to other faiths. And I think this is a very modern phenomenon that religious institutions feel they have to have exclusivist claims. So for me, it's never been a personal issue.
Thanks there to Mona Siddiqui, Professor of Islamic Studies and Public Understanding at Glasgow University. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.